Continuing our reflections in the book of Kings and looking at the story of Elijah, the stories of Elijah. And this morning, my title is Faith in a Faithless Society. And we're going to think a little bit around that issue this morning and hopefully allow the Bible to speak to us as we go. Let's read the text. So the text starts with these words, 1 Kings chapter 18. After a long time, in the third year, the word of the Lord came to Elijah. Go and present yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the land. So Elijah went to present himself to Ahab. Now, in case you're a visitor here or you've not really been tracking with what's going on in this story, Ahab was one of the kings of Israel several hundred years before Christ. His reign was generally deemed to be a bad reign. He was not viewed as a good and godly king. In fact, far from it, as we will see as we consider this a little more. God had sent a kind of a strong, powerful reminder of his displeasure with what was happening within Israel in the form of a drought. And Elijah had been the person who'd gone to Ahab the king 3 years ago. This is in 2012, and said to him, Ahab, because of God's displeasure at what's happening in the land, there's going to be no water. There's going to be a drought. Now, that didn't make Elijah deeply popular. And so Elijah ran and hid, and God provided for him, and we considered some of those stories over the last few weeks. But now, 3 years on, that's quite a long time, isn't it? 3 years to sit and wonder what on earth's going on, to sit and wonder if God is really going to come through on his promise, to sit and wonder whether all that you can see around you, the desolation in the land, could really have anything at all to do with God. 3 years is a long time. Waiting 3 days is a long time. Waiting 3 years is a very, very long time. And somehow, through that period of time, when as far as we know, Elijah has been hiding in that little village that we thought about 2 weeks ago called Zarephath, sheltered in the house of a widow woman, dependent on some somewhat miraculous provision to survive at all, there in that little house of the widow woman, he must have been reflecting and praying and considering whether he'd got it right, whether he would really gone off on one when he'd gone to Ahab, whether, you know, he must have been wondering, mustn't he? Maybe not, maybe you think that differently, but I am imagining that he must have wondered in that long three-year period. I mean, that's three Christmases. Maybe not for him. 3 years is a long time. And somehow, within those 3 years, he'd kept his soul in a sufficiently alert state that God could speak 3 years into that time and say, now's the time, Elijah, for you to do something else. He must have built rhythms, he must have built security, he must have become accustomed to living in that place. But suddenly, on the one hand, he had to have enough faith to still hear God speaking, and on the other hand, he had to have enough courage to leave that place that had become a place of security and provision and to put himself back in the firing line by going to Ahab. It's quite a hard thing to hold on to faith during times and seasons when not a lot seems to be happening. During the ordinary seasons of life, we'd like every day to be a fantastic, miraculous reminder that God is really here and God is really on the move, but sometimes days are not like that. Sometimes days are just ordinary. Any Anglicans or recovering Anglicans here this morning? Some of you will know that the Anglicans and other church traditions mark out the year with special seasons like Advent, to remind ourselves of the coming and second coming of Christ, like Easter, to remind ourselves of death and resurrection at the heart of the Christian story. There are special kind of seasons like Lent and so on. But there's huge chunks of the year where nothing special happens. And do you know what they call that? Ordinary time. Yeah, ordinary time is punctuated by things like Trinity Sunday and Kingdom Sunday. But actually, the period is just called ordinary time. It's kind of acknowledgement that a lot of life is just ordinary time. And somehow in the middle of that, Elijah's ordinary time, which lasted for 3 years, as far as we know, is the challenge is to remain alert enough to still hear God and courageous enough that should God speak into ordinary time, we're willing to do the extraordinary thing. to move on, to break the boundaries, to walk upon the water, to use the story that Paul's just discovered in the Bible. So Elijah went to present himself to Ahab. If you're living in ordinary time, stay alert. If God's speaking to you at the end of ordinary time and saying, there's an extraordinary moment, move on. Be courageous and move on. Now, the famine was severe in Samaria, and Ahab had summoned Obadiah, his palace administrator. Obadiah was a devout believer in the Lord, while Jezebel, that's Ahab's missus, was killing off the Lord's prophets. Obadiah had taken 100 prophets and hidden them in 2 caves, 50 in each, and had supplied them with food and water. Ahab had said to Obadiah, "Go through the land to all the springs and valleys. Maybe we can find some grass to keep the horses and mules alive, so we will not have to kill any of our animals." Great king! Here's a king presiding over God's people, all of whom are starving and dying, and he's worried about keeping his horses alive. Why? Because his horses represented to him security and strength and the possibility, maybe, of making war should anybody attack. "Thank you, Ahab, very much," said Israel, "for your attention to our needs." So they divided the lands they were to cover, Ahab going in one direction, and Obadiah in another. And Obadiah was walking along. As Obadiah was walking along, Elijah met him. Obadiah recognized him, bowed down to the ground, and said, "Is it really you, my lord Elijah?" "Yes," he replied. "Go tell your master, Elijah is here." "What have I done wrong?" asked Obadiah, "that you are handing your servant over to Ahab to be put to death? As surely as the Lord your God lives, there is not a nation or kingdom where my master has not sent someone to look for you. And whenever a nation or kingdom claimed you were not there, he made them swear that they could not find you. But now you tell me to go to my master and say, Elijah's here." He was worried. "I don't know where the Spirit of the Lord may carry you when I leave you," he said. "If I go and tell Ahab and he doesn't find you, he will kill me. Yet I, your servant, have worshipped the Lord since my youth. Haven't you heard, my Lord, what I did while Jezebel was killing the prophets of the Lord? I hid 100 of the Lord's prophets in 2 caves, 50 in each, and supplied them with food and water. And now you tell me to go to my master and say, Elijah is here? He'll kill me." Elijah said, "As the Lord Almighty lives, whom I serve, I will surely present myself to Ahab today." And that's the story that we're just considering briefly together this morning. One of the challenges of the story is to think who represents what and who's doing what and who's where. And behind this story, there's the big story of what God is up to in space and time, what God is up to in history. And if I could just rewind a bit to kind of reapproach the story and think of God's desire, God's heart, God who is beyond any of our imagination. None of us could possibly begin to grasp the bigness, the majesty, the incomprehensible bigness of God. And yet, this God, according to the Bible, is a God who wants to be known. He wants to be in relationship. He wants to love and be loved. So there is a dilemma, in a sense, in the heart of God, because his sheer bigness means that our sheer smallness cannot grasp him. He's kind of beyond us, really. So God has to, as it were, if you forgive the language, construct a strategy which says, how on earth can I make myself known to these people whom I love and who I desire to be in relationship with? And a major part of his plan was to form a body of people who somehow reflected and carried his presence into the world. We find his strategy in those words buried back in Genesis to Abraham. The Lord said to Abraham, go from your country, your people, your father's household to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse, and all the peoples on earth will be blessed through you. God's heart to be known by everyone was to take his residence amongst someone. Got it? Hey, the plan was not to create a special people whose specialness was special to them and special to God, but a specialness which actually overflowed into everybody else so that the God who could not be known suddenly could be known because his presence was discerned amongst a people. And these people were called to embody the very character and nature of God. If you obey me fully and keep my covenant, out of all nations, you will be my treasured possession. It's not that God doesn't care about all nations. Quite the reverse. It's because he cares about all the nations that he needs one in which he can be embodied in such a way that everybody else can get it and get him. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. There'll be something distinct, something special, something radiant about you, which actually radiates with the very essence of the character and love of God. And so the calling on Israel, Moses was told to speak to the entire assembly of Israel, say to them, be holy, be distinct, be different, because God is holy. The only way that anybody will get what God is like is if you're like it. What a high calling. If you don't be holy, that's not good English, is it? Sorry, English teachers. You know what I mean? If you refuse this commission, if you refuse to be holy, then everything is lost because the hope is that you will radiate me into the world. Isaiah, one of the Old Testament prophets, fantastic verse at the end of his verses at the end of his book in the Bible. Arise, shine, for your light has come. This is addressed to Israel, to the nation of God, to the family of God, the household of God. Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord rises upon you. See, darkness covers the earth, and thick darkness is over the people, but the Lord rises upon you, and his glory appears over you. What's the significance of that? Well, nations will come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your dawn. You see, the hope of the nations is not in the nations. The hope of the nations is not in what the nations can do. The hope of the nations is Israel radiating brightly the presence and glory of God into the world. If God's people don't radiate God's presence and God's character, God's perfect love and mercy and grace and kindness and truth, if God's people don't radiate that, then the world has lost its only hope of knowing God. That's the way God set it up. Might not be the way you or I would have set it up, but that's the way God seems to have set it up. So when Israel, in Elijah's day, had become so bankrupt of godliness, had completely turned its back on God, we find that time after time they had chosen not to reflect the glory of the one true God, but to give themselves to all kinds of other idols. Idols are simply places where we find our security and where we find our hope. And they had decided that God alone was not enough security and did not offer enough hope, so they would kind of spread their bets a bit. And they would adopt all of the other gods of the nations amongst whom they found themselves dwelling. And of course, Jezebel, Ahab's wife, had brought with her the gods of her nations, and they had deeply embedded themselves within Israel's practices. So that it wasn't that they entirely rejected God, but they had tempered God's holiness with all of these other isms, these other deities. Here's a lengthy passage, but I thought about cutting it down, but I just want to read it all to give the impact. This is from 2 Kings. All this took place because the Israelites had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up out of Egypt from under the power of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. They turned against him. They worshipped other gods and followed the practices of the nations the Lord had driven out before them, as well as the practices that the kings of Israel had introduced. The Israelites secretly did things against the Lord their God that were not right. From watchtower to fortified city, they built themselves high places in all their towns. These are places for idol worship. They set up sacred stones and Asherah poles on every high hill and under every spreading tree. At every high place, they burned incense, as the nations whom the Lord had driven out before them had done. They did wicked things that aroused the Lord's anger. They worshipped idols, though the Lord had said, "You shall not do this." The Lord warned Israel and Judah through all the prophets and seers, turn from your evil ways, observe my commands and decrees in accordance with the entire law that I commanded your ancestors to obey and that I delivered to you through my servant the prophets. But they would not listen and were as stiff-necked as their ancestors who did not trust in the Lord their God. They rejected his decrees and the covenant he'd made with their ancestors and the statutes he'd warned them to keep. They followed worthless idols and themselves became worthless. Note that, they became worthless. They couldn't any longer manifest and radiate the truth and beauty and holiness of God into the world because they'd chosen to form their life around other beliefs, around other sources of security and hope. They became worthless. They imitated the nations around them, although the Lord had ordered them, do not do this. I mean, that's a lengthy litany of woes pronounced, notice, not against the nations, but against God's people, against Israel. You've actually lost the plot. We could grossly oversimplify and summarize this. The way that you were supposed to tick, you're not ticking anymore. You're functioning differently, and so you've become worthless. Jeremiah picks up a similar theme. Hear the word of the Lord, you descendants of Jacob, all you clans of Israel. This is what the Lord says. What fault did your ancestors find in me that they strayed so far from me? They followed worthless idols and became worthless themselves. Has a nation ever changed its gods? Yet they're not really gods at all. But my people have exchanged their glorious God for worthless idols. Be appalled at this, you heavens, and shudder with great horror. This is of enormous consequence. This is cosmically important. The purity and holiness and truthfulness of God's people is enormously cosmically important. Shudder, you heavens. My people have committed two sins. They've forsaken me, the spring of living water, and they've dug their own cisterns, their own reservoirs, broken cisterns that cannot hold water. They're still trying to live the life, but they've turned their back on the river of life. They think they can do it their own way. They think they can find their security through other means. They think they can find their hope in other directions. But it's a false hope, and not, well, everybody suffers. Everybody suffers. When God's people lose the desire to be a holy nation and a holy people, everybody suffers. The people themselves in Elijah's day were suffering terribly through turning their backs on God. They cut themselves off from the source of living water, and physically they began to experience what they themselves had done to themselves spiritually. They had chosen spiritually to enter drought, and God, in trying to burn into their hearts the significance of what they'd done spiritually, allows them to experience physically what their spiritual choices had actually brought about. See what's happening? The people were in pain, but the deep pain that God wanted to get to them, it wasn't punishment, it was correct. It was trying to say, look, can you not see the significance of turning your back on me, of trying to live life your way, of trying to just keep all these idols happy? You've got nothing. You're bankrupt. Spiritually, you're empty. The people lost out. Let's not overlook the fact that God frequently, through the prophets of the Old Testament, expresses his own grief. This is not anger in terms of like violent rage. This is deeply held pathos. This is actually God saying, I'm deeply upset that my kids have turned away from me. The children whom I love, the people, remember that passage in Hosea, did I not teach you how to walk? And yet you've turned your back on me. You're walking away from me. And the story of the prodigal son that Jesus tells kind of sums up all of this deeply felt hurt in the heart of God and the longing to be reconciled with his children. God loses out when his people turn their back on him. But of course, significantly and deeply, who loses out is the world, the nations, because now the light that should have been there, the mirror that should have been reflecting God's image into the world, is so cracked and deformed that nobody can see God clearly anymore. Nobody understands what God is really like. Nobody can catch his heart of love and justice and mercy and kindness and faithfulness, because actually it's become distorted and broken and lost. And so God sends the prophets. God acts, God intervenes, God speaks in order to bring his people back to their senses and say, come on, you are the hope of the world, you are the light of the nations. If you do not get your act together, if you do not keep yourself true to me, if you do not live in faithful obedience to me, then the world is lost. Never mind your personal feelings, never mind what's happening in your local community. The world is lost. I'm sorry, I'm getting a bit overexcited here this morning, but what this story seems to me to suggest is that there are three ways of being church. One represented by Ahab. Ahab we might describe as the pragmatist. He wanted a good life. And so he reckoned the easy way to get a good life was just to keep everybody happy, to take on Jezebel's gods, to take on the Canaanites' gods, just to kind of, as I said, spread his bets, just to kind of keep things equitable. And his desire was to keep in step with the world. Let's keep everyone happy. We don't want to upset anybody by saying we don't want to follow your gods. We don't want to upset any of the other nations by saying we don't like their gods. Let's just keep everybody happy. Let's keep in step with the world, and then we'll be a people that everybody loves. I hear that all the time in different parts of the church and see it in different parts of the church. The worst thing we could do is make people unhappy. So let's just do things the way everybody else does things. Let's just go with the flow that everybody else is going with. There's a way of doing church that kind of centers around that kind of philosophy of Ahab, which is let's just take everything on board and then everybody will be happy. Because after all, the worst sin we all know is to upset anyone. Obadiah represents a different kind of church. Obadiah, remember, is commended in that passage. He's called a godly man. He was the person who rescued these prophets that Jezebel was going to kill and hid them in caves, two sets of 50 in different caves, and took them bread and water. He's a good man. But don't overlook the fact that in that passage, as you will have noticed, he is described as the head of Ahab's household. That is a formal title. That is a significant job. He is keeping the whole Ahab show on the road. There's a kind of a deep compromise there, isn't there, in the heart of Obadiah. There's a conflict there. On the one hand, Obadiah is somebody who's noted as godly. He cares for the prophets. He's willing to stick his neck out a little bit, at least, and support and nourish these prophets in exile. And yet, his day job is to support Ahab and his policies. How many of us face that dilemma? Where we have a deeply held personal belief, but our day job is to support a culture which is profoundly anti-godly. It's a very common and very contemporary dilemma that Obadiah faced. And his response, the way he handled that, it seems, was to say, well, let's forget what's happening in culture because we can't change that. Let's forget what's happening in the nation because there's nothing I can do about that. All I can do is to be personally faithful to God and save a few souls from out of this corrupt and fallen regime. I think that's an inadequate view of what God wants the church to be. This kind of bunch of individuals who've got an individualized faith, trying to save people as individuals, but actually have given up any hope that the big thing can be affected in any way, shape, or form. The third view is embodied in Elijah and these bunches of prophets that Obadiah has saved. I don't know how much you know about the Old Testament prophets, but they are an incredible bunch. The distinctive of the prophets, well, there are many distinctives, but their communities, do you notice in the Old Testament they often come in groups? There's two bunches of 50 here. There's that bunch of prophets that King Saul meets. Do you remember he goes to meet them and they're all prophesying and he kind of starts prophesying and everybody says, oh, Saul, you've gone a bit wacky too. And then Elisha, in the next bit of the story in 2 Kings, he has a bunch of prophets and they say, hey, look, there's too many of us, Elisha. We need to build a new conference center. And they start building a new conference center and one of them loses their axe head and Elisha has to get the axe head out. You remember these stories. The prophets come in bunches. And sometimes they're introduced in the Old Testament as being a son of the prophet, which simply means a pupil in the prophetic school. So the prophets weren't just random individual, rugged individuals who were kind of going around Israel telling the kings off. They were actually bunches of people who embodied within them the very heart of God for the nation. They were groups of people who spent time seeking God and living for God, and the only way they could find to do that, the only hope they could see for the nation was if they, within their prophetic schools, stayed true to God. That's a really important insight. Ignore that. So this idea of a prophetic church, this idea of a group of people who are totally on fire for God, who are totally sold out for God, who are willing to give everything for God, whose heart is not to be popular, whose heart, in fact, the prophets were not popular. Often they were vilified, they were ignored, they were abused, they were killed. Jesus talked to the Pharisees of his day and said, you're just like your fathers who killed the prophets. The prophets were actually people who were looked down on by society at large. But God looked up to them. God actually honored them. God used them. People whose hearts were set on what he wanted. Communities of people within God's people, within Israel, who were willing to stand up and say, actually, whatever else is happening in wider Israel, whatever else is happening in God's people more widely, we are willing to stand here and burn for him. Not many of you look very impressed by that idea. Sooner have a Sunday morning meeting, go home and forget it all, wouldn't you really? But this is the calling. This is the calling of this kind of church, a prophetic church. A prophetic church, not a pathetic church, a prophetic church. The prophets were people who were expectant. Remember what Elijah said at the end of this story. As the Lord my God lives, I will present myself to Ahab today. They were expectant that God was still alive and was still able to intervene and to act, and therefore that his word was the ultimate word to respond to. They submitted to him. Elijah described him as the Lord God Almighty. Only his word is worth listening to. Only his spirit is worth being filled with. Only his life is worth living. They were people who were attentive to God, constantly listening. The prophets were marked out by their willingness to stand in the counsels of God, to spend time, to take time out from what the rest of Israel were doing, to pay attention to what God wanted to say and what God wanted done. They were courageous people. They were willing to give everything. They were willing to be sacrificed if necessary. They would sooner die than see God's name defamed or God's word lost. And therefore, they were very single-minded people. They believed that the God life was the only life worth living. Unlike Ahab, who was willing to see there were lots of God's lives that may be worth living, let's try a bit of them all just to keep everyone happy. And like Obadiah, who said, well, there is a God life that's worth living, but there's another life that really... They said, no, somewhere in the middle of ordinary life, we need to establish something that's pulsing and burning with the very heart of God. We need a community of people who are distinct, who are God listeners, God worshippers, God obeyers, God livers, because that kind of community is the hope for the world. That's the kind of community that radiates with the holiness and life of God. It's so far beyond church as a Sunday morning experience. It's so far beyond church as a set of rules to obey. It's so far beyond church as a kind of a personal piety that kind of keeps me feeling okay in my life. This is a radical, big, global vision, but it rests on God's people being God's people, stepping up to the plate and owning this commission to be holy as I am holy, so that the nations will see your light. Peter picks up this idea in the New Testament, in case you think this is all too Old Testament and something must have happened to make it more nice. Peter says, dear friends, I urge you as foreigners and exiles, you don't belong here, to abstain from sinful desires which wage war against your soul. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. See what Peter's saying there? If you live the God life, some people will think you're nuts, some people will look down on you, just like they did the prophets, but some people will see what you're about because they'll be blessed by it and they'll be attracted by it and they'll be challenged by it and they'll want to glorify the God that you're radiating with. That's the strategy. So, are you up for a bit of radiating? Are you up for a bit of burning? Well, three of us are half nodding. It's a big challenge. I don't make light of it. It's a big challenge, and maybe not. We're not all up for it. But I believe it's Britain's hope. Britain's hope is not in redeeming its politics or its social structures. Britain's hope, as I read my Bible, is about bunches of people burning and radiating with the holiness of God throughout every community, every town, every village. And somehow, from those places, those prophetic schools, as it were, those bunches of people who will not give up hope in a true and living God, the hope not just of Britain, but of every nation rests. That's why it's important to see our primary identification as being Godish, not British. When that happens, all kinds of stuff overflows. I want to play a video, just a short video clip, just to finish with. Some of you may have seen this. J. John. When the church is really the church, it's not just an introverted thing. It's not just that suddenly we're great. It's actually something that blesses. And I don't know if you've seen this J. John clip, but it says to me a lot about how beautiful the church is, how wonderful the church is. I don't mean the local church. I don't mean Thornby Baptist Church. I mean the church, God's people. When actually they're radiating with his kind of life in the world. Let's see if we've got some sound going here.
People often say to me, they say, J. John, you know, what do you do? And it's always very difficult to know what to say. Because if I say to you that I'm a reverend, which I am, that conjures up certain images in people's minds as to what I might be. So I like to be a little bit creative in telling people what I do. I sat next to this lady on an aeroplane at Heathrow Airport, and I said, hello. And she said, well, hello. And I said, where are you going? And she says, I'm going to Singapore. Then she said to me, where are you going? I said, I'm going to Australia. I said, what do you do? So she told me. Then she said, what do you do? And I said, well, I work for a global enterprise. She said, do you? I said, yes, I do. I said, we've got outlets in nearly every country of the world. She said, have you? I said, yes, we have. I said, we've got hospitals and hospices and homeless shelters. I said, we do marriage work. We've got orphanages. We've got feeding programs, educational programs. I said, we do all sorts of justice and reconciliation things. I said, basically, we look after people from birth to death and we deal in the area of behavioral alteration. She went, wow! And it was so loud, her wow, loads of people turned around and looked at us. She says, what's it called? I said, it's called the church.
Isn't that wonderful? Kind of sums up much better than I've been trying to, but the significance of God's people being God's people, of being charged with his love and grace and mercy and kindness, and refusing to temper that or dilute that with anything else, so that we can be this light to the nation and light to the nations that God called us to be. We ask Paul to come back, and we're just going to respond and draw towards a close with a song. So give us a chance, if we wish, this morning to reaffirm our willingness to be part of such a group, to be part of such a calling, to live under this fantastic challenge, not just have a privatized faith, not just to kind of believe a bit of this and a bit of that, but to say, actually, I'm with Elijah. I want to hear the word of God and I want to obey it. I want to be part of a group of people that are doing that. And I want to manifest that, not for ourselves, but for the good of those around us, to be part of a global enterprise that's into all those things. Let's stand together, shall we? We'll sing something.
Sing a little song, We Bow Down.
We Bow Down.